Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harris, and it's my privilege to serve as the anchor of the show. It's an ensemble program with lots of good people involved, and the host and the founder of the show is Carol Marx. Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. And now let's begin with Carol Marx in conversation with Annabelle Gurwitch. Annabelle Gurwitch is an actress and comedian and New York Times bestselling author. She's going to talk to Carol about her book, I See You Made an Effort, Compliments, Indignities, and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50, published by Plume.
Now, I want to start out by saying that your family history would make a great memoir. Because you grew up Jewish in the South, you were descended from fur trappers and bootleggers, and why did your neighbors call your family colorful?
Yes, well, you know, that's what, colorful in the South means. You people are crazy. And I'm starting to write a book about my family. But, you know, there's a lot of advantages to having a colorful history. It makes you recognize a good story, and I think that's why, you know, for many years I was an actress, and I still act. I was a host of a show called Dinner and a Movie, but now as a writer, I'm always trying to find, good stories, they're just everywhere, but I notice them, and that's what this book is. It's a collection of essays, and I wrote this book in a certain way, in the essay style, because each chapter really stands for moments when you realize your life is different. As for me, as you know, hitting 50 was this moment of like, wow, things have changed. When I would take my son to a concert, I have a teenage son, and I would realize I am invisible to the teenagers that I am standing with. Wow, this is like Einstein's theory of parallel universes. Age has spun me into an alternate universe. You know, sometimes it was a wake-up call for me, but it was a funny wake-up call, I have to say. And so, you know, each story is about different ways the world sees you, the way you see the world, and how that's changed. And so I use, you know, anecdotes from my life to illustrate
and
that.
And, you know, it makes you smile. But your book does raise a very serious question because it asks, you know, how are we supposed to age today? We don't have a similar template to model ourselves after as our mothers and our grandmothers had.
Yes, well, you know, that's the thing is, you know, we're being called, like people who are my age, you know, being called like a sandwich generation. And what that refers to is, like many people my age, I'm a working person. So I was working. I had my first kid when I was 37. So that means I've got a kid at home, I've got aging parents, I'm still working, I'm stretched in between all these things. I'm the sandwich. I'm the meat in the sandwich. And you're just constantly being pressed upon by all that bread, you know. And, of course, there's an irony to being called the sandwich generation because at this age, carbohydrates are just like a distant memory. When I went to the supermarket, I am always saying I walk through the bakery and I just look at it like breads of my youth. Because if I eat a cashew, I have to change pant size at this age. So, you know, these are the stresses that I'm writing about that, you know, that lead to these moments where we don't have a role model. I mean, my mother was a grandmother when she was my age. I was out of college. You know, when my mother was my age, I was out of college. My grandmother had many grandchildren at the age I am now, and I've got a teenager, and at any given moment, I have more chin hairs than my teenage son. It's, you know, there's some indignities there.
I'm sure. And, you know, the other thing is that even if we are members of the sandwich generation, and we have our children and our parents in our life, we still are expected to be fit and look beautiful and Botoxed, and at the same time, our body parts are giving into the gravitational forces that are natural. So any comments about that? Because I think that produces lots of stress.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what's so, I think, confusing for people is, and when I say people, I mean me. You know, when you are this age, you start noticing things like I'm at the supermarket And I see this magazine, and it says, looking good at 20, 30, 40, and beyond. I think, what, they're sending me to the great beyond? And then you'll see when people do talk about people, you know, aging, you'll say, well, Elle McPherson, when I was turning 50, Elle McPherson was turning 50. And I was thinking, well, that's so great. She was Elle McPherson to begin with. And she's got a trainer who works out every muscle of her body and cooks her delicious lentil soup all day. So she can look however she wants to look. But what about the rest of us? And I think that those messages that we get become, you know, difficult and become sort of, you don't know how you're supposed to look. And really the premise of this book is that I began to feel that there was a canard, this 50 is the new 40 thing. You know, I just thought this is doing us a disservice, because then you're constantly feeling, oh, you shouldn't be the age you are, and there's something disempowering about that. I mean, first of all, it's ridiculous and hilarious, because when you're 50, no one who's 40 thinks you're the same age as them, unless you've got a lot of tattoos and probably even a facial tattoo. But, you know, it does us a disservice to not be the age we are, because then it means that you're denying all the life experience that you've had. So there's a way in which this little saying was supposed to sort of make you feel really good, like, hey, I'm still young. But I think it does exactly the opposite. It makes you feel sort of shameful about the age that you actually are. So,
you know, if there's
a message in my book, it's to, you know, embrace the age you actually are. And we don't know what it means. And I don't really have an answer to that, except that I think that the answer lies somewhere in asking the question, why are we all trying to say we're a different age?
Right. Well, part of it is youth obsession of our culture, but
absolutely.
You go on to say in your book that you'd like to retire the phrase aging gracefully. So how are you aging?
I am aging with a vengeance. I prefer that instead. I feel like aging gracefully sounds like, oh, we're sitting in a rocking chair and knitting. Now, first of all, knitting is fantastic. I'm nothing against knitting. But I just feel like it's a very sedentary type of thing. And it's also not true for me. I prefer to say aging with a vengeance, because I feel like aging with a vengeance implies the kind of righteous anger that I can get that really is motivating to me. And I am, you know, one of those reinventors that so many of us are at this age, which means, of course, I've changed careers. I'm not acting so much. I'm writing. And by the way, you know, listen, 50 is 80 in actress years. So, you know, it wasn't like I said. I woke up one day
like, all that prejudice.
Let's stop acting. It's just the way it is. But, you know, a lot of us have changed careers at this age, and, you know, you have to stay very motivated. And I find a dwindling bank account and righteous indignation to be very powerful motivators.
Now, let's talk about some of the other things that women endure in the name of vanity,
mm-hmm.
and how our society dictates so many of the things. Now, you know, one of my peeves is that it seems that the modern-day version of that awful thing called a corset is back, the spandex undergarment. It's so uncomfortable. And
that's really funny you say that, because the spandex thing, I resisted for a long time, and now I actually wear it, because I actually find it to be, it helps with my posture. You know, my husband is like, how could they take a word that's so much fun and turn it into something that looks so awful? But I really admire the woman who invented them, you know, who came up with this fabric and this design. She's a billionaire, and she's very philanthropic. That's Sarah Blakely, and I admire her greatly, because, you know, it does kind of smooth out the clothing. But that's just a tip.
It can be very uncomfortable for all those rolls that you're trying.
Well, yes, you mean absolutely. But, you know, that's really the tip of it. There's a billion-dollar cosmeceutical industry whose whole goal is to separate you from your money while trying to sell you these products that I find to be something of a zero-sum game. Not that I don't buy them, but I mean, I definitely draw the line. It's silly. It's like a line in the sand. Like, I've never bought that one. This is the one that I think is really morally bankrupt. Hope in a jar. I pass that in the department store, and I think, is there a miniature time machine inside that little jar. They just know, they're just preying on us. What is inside that hope in a jar? The day I buy hope in a jar miracle cream is the day I start, you know, making animal sacrifices and sleeping in a hyperbaric chamber. That's where I've drawn the line. But
and I bet it was very expensive, too.
Of course, these things are so expensive. And I actually wrote about that for the New York Times, about these adjectives and adverbs they use. And, I mean, there's a product by Armani that's like $2,000. And what is it? I mean, what could possibly be in there? It's like, and they keep it under lock and key. And there are people who sell it to you at the department store are wearing white lab coats like they're doctors. And they're not doctors.
No.
They're salespeople. And it's just, you know, but they know that, you know, all of us, you know, many of us are thinking about that. And the truth is, I think, you know, I don't have any judgment on what anyone does. I just want to say that because I understand, you know, the feelings. I mean, And this is where I think it's so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, comedic fodder is that I will look at a photograph or read about one of my heroes, Jane Goodall, and I'll think, Jane Goodall, she is, you know, just making, you know, aging look fantastic. She's doing what she loves to do. She's contributing to the world. And then I'll think, and she looks pretty good. I wonder what kind of sunscreen she's using.
She needs a lot of sunscreen where she was in Africa.
Totally. So that's the irony. I think, well, how does she do that?
That's Annabelle Gurwitch in conversation with Carol Marx. Her book is titled, I See You Made an Effort, Compliments and Dignities and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50. It's published by Plume. Carol Marx returns in conversation with Alan Gelb, a writing coach and a widely published author of fiction and nonfiction. He's going to talk about his forthcoming book, Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. That's next when A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marx, in conversation with Alan Gelb. Alan Gelb is a writing coach and is a widely published author of fiction and nonfiction. He's going to talk to Carol about his forthcoming book titled, Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. It's published by Tarcher.
As a boomer, you are also aware of the passage of time. You've written that your motivation for writing this book came from some of the funerals you attended. You felt something was missing, and what was it that you felt was not there?
Well, that's true. You know, as we get older, we unfortunately have that work of sitting at the funerals of people that mean a lot to us. And, you know, I hate to be sort of someone who critiques funerals because actually that's a very small part of my experience sitting there. But, you know, often when I go to one, I feel like, oh, I wish I could have heard the voice of the person one last time, you know? And, you know, I very much appreciate the words that people say about their loved ones, but I also want to hear the voice of that person. Sometimes the voice of that person is so distinctive, and it's kind of in the room in our memories, but I'd love to hear it more stage center. And, you know, given my work with students of 17 and 18 applying for colleges, and realizing that what they do essentially is a life review exercise, I was thinking of adapting that work to people my age and older, because they are really in the position of benefiting a lot from that kind of life review as well. And one of the things that you mentioned, you know, in your introduction was that this is not for people who are, into writing memoirs or journal writing, that stuff is great, and if you are, all the better. But a lot of people don't see themselves as writers. A lot of the young people I work with don't see themselves as writers, but if you understand the form, then you can, of the narrative, then you can really bring yourself to a position where you can write something meaningful in 500 to 1,000 words that can be left as a keepsake for people in your lives, or that can be read at your own memorial service and be extremely meaningful.
Now, didn't you first try your new idea about creating written legacies in the form of small stories with a group of diverse, mature adults who were all new to this form of writing, and how did that group writing process go?
Well, that's absolutely right. I gathered a group of guinea pigs who were very cooperative, who happened to be people I knew. They came out of my faith community, my synagogue, in a small town here in upstate New York, and I just put the word out, hey, I'm doing something a little odd. Would you like to try it? And they were hearty souls, so they agreed to do that. And you know, I started by writing one myself so that, you know, they could model it. And what I wrote about was, what I want to convey here is that this, there's a million things people can write about. You know, this doesn't have to be a huge story. It could be a small story. My story was about meeting my son when he was about 18, 19 years old in Grand Central Station in New York City. And we went up to our house, which was 2 hours away on the train, and we met a man who was delayed at his stop, which was right before our stop. He missed his stop. And I drove him back from my stop, one stop back to his stop. And it was about sort of like conveying the idea to my son that you always try to do the right thing, you know? So this story was about an ethic that I've lived by, which is trying to do the right thing for people, and it was something that I was trying to pass on to him. And the whole concept of these last days comes out actually of a Jewish precept of ethical wills, which were documents, legal documents, that people wrote dating back to biblical times. Actually, Jacob did it with his sons, Joseph and the others, and they were about how parents would like their children to try to live, you know, what values they would like them to live by. But they're legal documents and therefore not that easy to read. And I thought, well, why can't you adapt that to a narrative form and, you know, tell the story as kind of a homily in a narrative form. So I started with my story, and then my colleagues in this group picked up on their story. They went through an exploratory process, which I've devised, which involves answering, you know, about 30 questions.
And, you know, that's what makes your book so unique and helpful, because
it
is hard to pick the right topic that you want to write about in 500 to 1,000 words, and you have a whole list of questions that people can use to really self-examine themselves and their lives. And so can you just give us one or two of them?
Sure. I mean, the kind of questions that are in there, which are surprising and sort of all over the place, are, you know, if you close your eyes and picture yourself in a special place, which place is that? If something keeps you up at night, what is that thing? Has there been a time when your mind and body have felt in perfect harmony? And then these actually are a lot of these questions are the very same questions that I use with my 17 or 18-year-old college applicants. And what happens when you answer those questions, which are meant to be answered very quickly, almost sort of viscerally, is that you look them over and you see common relationships between them. You see themes developing. You see themes that come out in different answers, you know, which obviously indicate that has been a important force in your life. And then you start to sort of figure out how one of those answers can evolve, can develop into a narrative. So that's what that process is like. And it's quite fascinating because it just, you know, the idea of somebody picking out a moment from their life of, let's say, 70 years, you know, that in some way for them encapsulates an ethic or a moral that they've lived by, that's pretty powerful.
And that experience that you write about can also really change you and help you to become the person that you eventually became. So I think very, very interesting. Now, you said that in general, when it comes to writing your life story, it's going to take three drafts and a polish, and composing words for the first draft, I can imagine, can be very daunting. And you said that you should write your first draft as if you were writing to a friend using free writing. So what is free writing, and why is that helpful?
Well, free writing, actually, those are two different things, so let me just clarify that. Free writing is a writing exercise in which you just write. It's kind of like a limbering exercise, you know, what you do before you get down to some serious exercise, a stretching exercise. You know, you just write whatever comes into your mind. You don't worry about, any kind of mistakes from spelling to grammar or anything like that. You don't even worry about your content. You just sort of let it flow. It's a little bit like vocalizing or something also, you know. And that kind of opens the floodgates a bit, you know. And you might find a germ of an idea in that free writing, or you might not. It might just be purely, as I say, stretching, you know. The other idea of writing something as if in the form to a friend is good because some of us older folks, you know, remember what it was like to sit down and actually write letters. We're all doing emails now, of course, but an email is fine also, that form. And it just makes it, it gives you an object that you can write toward, which can be helpful to people. But the real method of how to get this done is to understand the narrative form, which the first two chapters of the book talk about. And the narrative form is like any form, like a dance move or a golf swing or anything that has a form, you know. And if you understand the elements of it, and I've sort of distilled it down to four elements, then you say, ah, I see, this is something that that has meaning for me, you know?
That's Alan Gelb in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. It's published by Tarcher. And if you'd like some more information, go to the website havingthelastsay.com, havingthelastsay.com. We'll continue with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, right here in just a moment. Michael Harrison here with you on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Very proud to be with you on this program. This program has been on the air in one form or another consistently now for over two decades. Kind of runs below the radar. It's heard on weekends on great talk radio stations around the country. And what I'm really proud about in terms of this program, in which I have the opportunity to serve as anchor, not as host. Carol Marx is the host, and I certainly am not the only voice on this show. We have a roundtable of outstanding personalities, experts, and broadcasters. What I love about this show is that in an industry marked by concern, focus, obsession with youth, and believe me, I'm about as young thinking as anybody you'll meet. Sometimes I'm even accused of being immature. And so I'm all for that, and I'm all for looking ahead. But I'm also also for fairness, and I'm also for respect. And the media in America, driven by, obviously, Madison Avenue and commercial concerns, focuses primarily on young people. And if somebody's over 50 or 55 or 60, they quite often find that there's a lot lacking in terms of what's available in the mainstream media. So this program, which was conceived and developed by Carol Marx more than 20 years ago, originally was called Senior Focus, and it evolved into A Touch of Grey, and I became involved with it along the way, is something that really provides a service in as much as it unashamedly, unabashedly, unapologetically brings information to people via this wonderful medium of radio that is of use, of interest, of service, of comfort, of support to people over 50 years of age and their families, which is why I say at the beginning of the program, children of all ages, because so many people in their 50s find themselves in a situation that has been kind of accurately and colorfully termed the sandwich generation, meaning they have children, adult children, still living with them, and abiding by the rule that came down a long time ago, honor thy father and thy mother, they have their parents living with them. In many cases, these parents are in their 80s, 90s, and are living in a home. And the amount of pressure that can be put on somebody dealing with adult children and senior parents all under one roof is extraordinary, and it's a phenomenon that in many ways I applaud. I'm all for families staying together. But also, there are people who are in need of support and information. So in many ways, A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, is in fact a program for children of all ages. But I salute Carol Marx. I think that she has done and continues to do a remarkable job. And she does it under sometimes the worst of conditions because, like the rest of us, she's not getting any younger either. But she drives herself to research and get the information needed and select guests and topics. And not only that, she travels around the world and brings information from other countries on how their healthcare systems operate and how the services that they provide for senior citizens there are taken care of and done. And she brings that information back, not to mention she acts as a model, as a role model for people to get up and get out and live life and do things. And she's done everything from, she's explored, you know, if there were four corners on this planet, as the saying goes, she's been to all four of them. Check her out at the website, atouchofgrey.com. Gray is spelled with an E. And I just wanted to mention that she is one fine lady, and we're grateful to be involved with her in this project.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgrey.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgrey.com. We spell gray with an E. A domain name is your key to doing business around the world, right from your office, living room, or even your couch. And finding the right name is as easy as a domain name search at hostingforcheap.com. Just enter the domain you want in the search box and we'll give you the results, along with similar domains you may not have considered. Most people looking for goods or services start on the web. Unfortunately, many small businesses can't afford to pay someone else to build their website. That's where hostingforcheap.com comes in. We can show you how to create a website for yourself, because hostingforcheap.com isn't just about domain names. It's a one-stop shop for anything you need to get online, from building your own website to attracting new customers to securing their data when they make a purchase. Hostingforcheap.com has you covered from the moment you decide you want to put your business on the web. That's hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and this is the time in the program when we're joined by the vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers that serves the talk radio industry. He's also a senior correspondent on the show, Kevin Casey. Welcome aboard, Kevin. What's going on in the world of talk media?
Well, there's always lots going on, but what about what you've been getting into lately with your podcast endeavor?
I've had a lot of fun with that. I got to tell you, we have a show, and it's not on the Talkers platform. It's actually on the Podcast One platform, podcastone.com, which is a place that has over 200 different podcasts, including those from very interesting people such as Adam Carolla. Stone Cold Steve Austin has a podcast.
One of the largest podcast platforms out there right now.
Yeah, and I was actually quite honored that they invited me to begin a podcast, which I did 7 weeks ago. I do it every Tuesday as a new one, and they're all there. And sure, let me tell our listeners about it, because so many people are interested in the media. It's about media, pop culture, politics, technology, how technology is changing our lives, the internet. It's quite, I say it's for media freaks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison. And up close meaning we really get into the details of things. Far out meaning we step back and we look at the big picture. And as you know, I've been known when it comes to media and technology and prognostications, looking at the future, looking around corners, looking over the horizon. I've been known to go a little bit far out because I really do believe that the Internet and that this information revolution that we are going through right now, I believe that it is one of the most exhilarating and forward-moving times in the history of the human race. I think that the Internet is every bit as big as the invention of the wheel or the invention of fire in terms of where it's sending us. I believe it's rewiring the human nervous system. So if people are interested... If people are interested in hearing some of these discussions, it's pretty heavy duty, and there are some interviews with fascinating people. Why don't you go to the website www.podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com. And then just type in Michael Harrison or Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison. Or if folks want to get tweets to find out what we have, they can plug into at Up Close Far Out. So it's podcastone.com, and then just look for Michael Harrison. And thanks for bringing it up, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Yeah, there's been some really interesting conversations, and I think folks who are into media will really enjoy hearing not only what you have to say, but what some of your guests have to say as well about all the topics that you've touched upon.
All right. Well, we will certainly look forward to more stuff from you, and if you're interested in talk radio, go to talkers.com. Thank you, Kevin Casey at Talkers. Coming up next, Richard Neer in conversation with Regina Leeds about organizing your life when A Touch of Gray continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. It is important to address a personal emergency response system in your home in case of falls or injuries. AARP encourages their use for many older Americans to enhance independence and security, especially for those living alone. Many brands of PERS are available on the market, and seniors should consider their specific needs and budget before deciding on a system. The Federal Trade Commission provides free online information. One can get a system as basic as wearing a necklace or bracelet and push a button that will transmit to an installed response center through your landline telephone. In the event of an emergency with falls, chest pain, a suspected intruder, a press of the button will have a 911 ambulance dispatched to your home, even if you cannot reach your phone. PERS systems can be rented or purchased through local hospitals and are affordable and serviced by representatives. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined now by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. He's going to be in conversation with Regina Leeds. Regina Leeds is the author of 9 books, including the national bestseller, 1 Year to an Organized Life. I better read it. She will talk about her new book, Right Size, Right Now, the 8-week plan to organize, declutter, and make any move stress-free, published by DiCapo Lifelong Books.
And Regina, before I even picked up your book, I thought, you know what? Moving is probably after divorce, funerals, serious illness, one of the things that we dread most. And sure enough, the first paragraph of your book, you reaffirmed that thought, didn't you?
It is. It's one of the top 10 stressors when it comes to experiences we can encounter. You know, it's very difficult, first of all, in terms of you've got a plan and you've got to go through a lot of details, and we're all already busy. But it's also a very emotional experience, because if you're responsible, you want to go through all of your stuff before you move, so that it's a strategic move and you're taking with you exactly what you need, want, and will use in the new space. And that's emotional, because it requires you to, you know, we're reminded of the things we purchased that we no longer use, the things we purchased that were mistakes, things that were left to us by those who have departed. There's just a lot of emotional upheaval.
Yeah, and even if it's to a better place, to a nicer place, even if you're moving kind of up, not in size, but just in, a more comfortable place, it still is traumatic, because there are so many emotional memories tied to the place itself, not just the possessions.
Yes, Yes, that's true. I moved a year and a half ago after being in the same place for decades. I just loved it, but I moved for the love of the dog. And it was very confrontive and very interesting. I stayed within the city of Los Angeles, but I was 8 miles away from where I had been. And when you're, that 8 miles meant, I had to find a new dry cleaner, a new branch of my favorite grocery store. I was encountering different traffic patterns. But, you know, if we take a mental adjustment, we can say that these changes help keep us youthful. It gets kind of boring to do the same old all the time. So that's how I chose to look at it. It hurt at first, you know, I missed everybody and everything, and then I thought, well, no, this is an opportunity to pretend that I'm much younger and I'm having a brand new experience. And I also think that whenever you move, it's the doorway to the next chapter. And that's very exciting. And I got to experience life in L.A. proper. I have to tell you that I'm a girl from Brooklyn, New York. I'm not an L.A. native. But I had lived for many years in the San Fernando Valley. And I got to experience life here in the heart of Los Angeles. And everybody, it's a very snobbish thing. You know, this is where you're supposed to live. And I found I didn't like it. And I'm looking forward to going back to the Valley. So there's another move in my future. So, you know, that's another thing. We have freedom. I don't mean to be cavalier by the amount of energy and work and time and money that goes into a move, but we don't have to be stuck, you know.
Well, and your title is professional organizer, and how do you come by that? There's no degree in professional organizing, is there?
No, and it's very, I'm sure one day there will be. It's very funny because when I started, I'm in my 27th year. And there are professional organizers everywhere now. It's a mushrooming field. But 27 years ago, nobody knew what I was talking about when I said I was a professional organizer. And they would say to me, well, what does that mean? What do you do? And I would say, well, I can come into your home and do an individual project like your closet or your garage or your bathroom, whatever. Or I can do the whole thing, because moving has always been my favorite thing to do for clients.
Well, you know, Regina, it's interesting because, and you state in the book, you should really be organized way, way before you're even thinking of moving, because if you just let it build up and build up and build up, it becomes a Herculean task as opposed to, you know, decluttering and organizing all along so that when the time to move finally comes, you have a little bit better beat on the situation.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you think about your environment as a place that is meant to love you and support you and nurture you so that you are free to do whatever it is you feel called to do at any particular time in life, you will view it differently. And I think Americans particularly, because our homes are so big, we allow them to become repositories of the past. Mm-hmm. And we keep accumulating, and we don't edit as we go along. And then we do. We create these gigantic, enormous, emotionally draining projects for ourselves when, you know, if we lived a little leaner and meaner, it wouldn't be so bad. Now, I'm a professional organizer, and I'm not into clutter, and I have a very lean environment. I moved from 1,200 square feet to 700. So I had to do some downsizing that I never imagined I would do. I had to sell or give away pieces I thought I was going to die with. But, you know, it really reinforced for me that it's not only just stuff, and I don't mean to be disrespectful about it in any way, but you can look at it that the stuff also has a life of its own. And when it's finished performing its task for you, you can bless it to go on and be with somebody else. I finally parted with my mother's antique collection, which I had always promised her I would keep, and it really wasn't me. It had nothing to do with me. And I, piece by piece, I either sold them or I gave them to friends, and I made sure that each piece went somewhere where it was wanted and loved and would be treasured. And that became a part of that journey. Every move I've done, whether it's for a client or for myself, they're all different, and it's really reflective of how you feel about what's in your environment.
Well, I'm a guilty of the perfectly good syndrome in that I see things that I don't need, I may never need, but they're perfectly good, and I don't want to throw them out, and I don't really know who to give them to or where to put them. What do you do in cases like that? How do you come to grips with that?
Well, you know, for me, it's a matter of understanding that there are certain commodities in life that you need to hold dear. We certainly hold money dear, and we certainly honor food. But I think that space is another commodity that we squander. And so, you know, we don't want to live in landfills, mini or major. And so we do want to find things a new home when we no longer need them, want them, or use them. And in the book, I have a vast selection of ways, creative ways you can offload things to somebody who really needs it right now. Goodwill is, I think, my favorite charity because they will take, you know, everybody has those broken pieces of equipment hidden in kitchen cabinets, and Goodwill will repair them and sell them. And, you know, just think of the wonderful circle of energy that happens there. You have this perfectly good toaster oven that you no longer use because you have a brand new one. Now you give it to Goodwill. You get a tax deduction. They spruce it up. They sell it. Somebody who could never afford a brand new one gets it. And then, you know, instead of sitting in your cupboard being unused, waiting for that maybe one day when the new one breaks and you've got a backup, now that is being used every day and servicing a family. So I think if we look at things differently, and, you know, if you give away a bag of screws or some small thing, you clean out the junk drawer. If you do need it again and you have to go purchase it, if it's just a couple bucks, I wouldn't get into self-recrimination. Oh, I knew I shouldn't have done that. Oh, why did I do that?
Exactly.
I would just say, well, this is $2 or $3 that I didn't expect to spend, and
move on.
That I do in fact need this.
You know,
time.
The other thing, and we only have a minute or so left. Regina, final thing for just a few seconds. The sentimental stuff that you referred to earlier. We keep so many things that our mothers or our brothers or somebody dear to us left, and we realize we don't need all of them. If we just had one or two items to remember them by, that's really enough. You don't need to keep drawers full of things that just remind you of that person.
No, absolutely not. And those things also can go out in the world and be useful. And then, you know, we've never, ever, ever had a person come back from the dead and say, why did you give away all my dresses or suits or whatever the physical object might be? I think we have to realize that we're holding on to them, but the person who has departed is no longer interested in them. Well, I certainly hope they're not. That would be a terrible thing to find out that you die and then you're still concerned about the stuff you left behind. But again, it's not about, you know, just dumping it all in some big dumpster. It's about taking the time to find it a really great home and to really honor that person through one or two really great pieces and showcase them. And showcase them in a way that when people come into your home, they notice that object or that photograph, and then you can tell the story about that person. And that is a beautiful way to keep that person alive. And shadow boxes allow you to do that. You know, you could have a photograph and then a swatch of fabric from a favorite dress that's being worn in that photograph. So that's the thing. Instead of just holding on to everything, find a beautiful, creative, nurturing way to put it on display and then share it with others.
That's Regina Leeds in conversation with Richard Neer. Her book is titled Right Size, Right Now, the 8-week plan to organize, declutter, and make any move stress-free. It's published by DeCapo Lifelong Books. Coming up next, more Touch of Gray when we continue in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. New guidelines from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for persons 65 and older reveal that if women drink more than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per occasion, and men 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks per occasion, you're at risk for illness or injury. As the body ages, the tolerance to alcoholic beverages decreases. Literally, at 65 and older, you're unable to process alcoholic beverages as, say, a person that is 45. Alcoholic overuse and intolerance can worsen mental confusion, problems with balance and falls, depressive disorders, dehydration, inadequate nutrition, adverse interaction with some medications, and can lead to social isolation. One drink is 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor, or the amount in a shot glass. Are you ready to acknowledge that at age 65 and older, that fewer than 7 drinks per week or 1 drink per day is the limit and offers you the advantages of leading a healthier and safer lifestyle? I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back. Loss of hair, lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. The shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dinovite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dinovite,
when I get to about 3/4.
Oh, no. I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order.
Dinovite.com.
Each and every day, she is getting a Dinovite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dinovite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We have a few more minutes here in the final segment of our program for reflection. I was thinking about some of the conversations we had earlier, and Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine mentioning the podcast that I had become involved in on the platform podcast1.com called Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison. On the last episode, I speak with a fellow by the name of Joe Shaka, who is the editor-in-chief of the Boston Herald. And the Boston Herald has been very involved in multi-platform media. He said that news organizations today can't just be newspapers, but they have to be multi-dimensional, multi-platform news organizations. And we're seeing that happening on so many levels. Things are changing so rapidly at this point in history. 2015 is the year. That means we're 15% of the way into the 21st century. And I know because this is a program aimed at upper demos, meaning basically people over 50 years old and serving their needs, their problems, the resource for better living for folks over 50, I assume that most of the people listening are natives of the 20th century. Now, when I say natives of the 20th century, that's kind of an interesting term. We live in the 21st century, and with each passing day and each passing year, it's becoming more and more like a new world for those of us who grew up in the 20th century. In media, the traditional outlets such as a radio, a television, a newspaper, a magazine are all merging into one concept. I call that the media station. That's a four-ring media circus. Radio doesn't really stand alone anymore with its own little radio on the table. Television sets, remember, it was a piece of furniture. Now it's something on the wall that's very thin, and we live in a world of screens. You get into a taxi cab, and there's a television on the back of the seat in front of you. When you go for the family drive, you put a video on for the kids in the back seat as opposed to one person running the family radio and everybody complaining, I want to listen to this station or that station. Of course, even if you do listen to the radio, basically it's for the driver because everybody else has earbuds and are in their own world. Actually, the day of mass media is coming to an end. And one of the things I often say is that we are becoming a technologically induced telepathic species. In terms of my podcast, that's the part that's far out. The name of the podcast is Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison. And when you hear that, it sounds like, what the heck? How far out are you? But think about it. We're becoming a technologically induced, that means technology is causing us to become telepathic. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is in any given moment, you can get into anybody else's head anywhere in the world. And at any moment, anybody in the world can get into your head. You can get into any body, kind of literally. And you can get into any body of information, kind of literally, in seconds, if not instantaneously. Well, that wasn't always possible. You could send your stuff to anybody, anywhere, and receive their stuff, information, content, pictures, video, sound, photographs. I can go on and on instantaneously. That's a form of technologically induced telepathy. If you'd like to hear more about these thoughts, and certainly those of you who are 50-plus listening to this program, you'll find it even more fascinating than perhaps kids who are used to this. This is the world they live in. Check it out at podcastone.com, podcastone.com, and then click in for Michael Harrison. And I think you'll find it a very interesting series. Thank you, Beverly Santinella, on the front line, our producer. Thank you very much to Kevin Casey and Richard Neer, our senior correspondents. And thank you, of course, to Carol Marks, the host and founder of this wonderful program that I'm so proud to be a part of as anchor. Michael Harrison here inviting you to join us next weekend for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.